Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy February to you all. Thank you for joining us for this week's installation of Them Before Us. This portion of your weekend, we hope, is going to fortify you and encourage you to stand up and speak out on behalf of children, the children in your world, the children of our nation. And so to that end, we spend the first portion of our radio show talking about what's happening in the world, what kind of trending news intersects with child protection and child rights. But before we get to that, we always kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. And today I am going to tell you what I spoke to, what I shared with about 400 Lutheran Students for Life right before they headed off for the March for Life in Washington, D.C. last Friday. And I've been going through the Bible in 30 days. I finished it. It was fantastic. It was the 30-day Bible shred. It was very valuable in a lot of ways. But as I was listening to God's commandment about child protection, really his entire moral law, much of which aims directly at elevating, protecting, and creating the next generation of the most vulnerable of our youngest citizens. And then he instructed them on how to go into the land of Canaan and what they needed to be concerned about, and specifically what forms of idolatry they needed to tear down. I said, oh my, isn't that interesting? The same kinds of idols that were threatening the rights of children right after the birth of the people of God when they were leaving Egypt is the same kinds of threats that we have to fight against today. So what specifically are those? What are the things that God said to go in and tear down? Don't imitate, don't be like them. Absolutely destroy them. Well, it mainly fell into three buckets. Number one was worship of Molech. That would be child sacrifice. Molech took the form of a man or a bull signifying strength. And what was he hungry for? He was hungry for children, for babies, for the weakest of all. So a picture of the strong requiring child sacrifice. And honestly, in our world today, we still have Molech worship. It comes in the form of abortion, which takes maybe a million little lives every year in our country. But it also, as we often talk about them at Them Before Us, it comes in the form of IVF, which destroys many times that number of little embryonic lives in service of baby making. The second major form of idolatry that the Israelites were required to tear down was Asherah. That would be the fertility goddess, the goddess who you would worship around these large poles. Obviously, there's kind of a fertility phallic reference there, but it was about reproduction, whether it was reproduction in your crops, but certainly reproduction in your own life in terms of like making babies. And so obviously we see a connection there between the idolatry of sort of a right to procreation, all of the reproductive rights that we see today, whether it is a right to choose abortion, whether it's a right to birth control, whether it's a right to parenthood, even if those children are going to be created in ways where they lose their mother or father, or even, you know, the right to make little babies in laboratories that will lose their life. And then finally, the sexual rites, R-I-T-E-S, the forms of worship that involved sexual rituals, including, you know, pause this if you've got little kids around, including things like homosexuality, temple prostitution, incest, bestiality. I mean, honestly, it was kind of the OG of the LGBTQ identity umbrella. So all of these things directly connect to child protection. When we get them wrong, children are harmed. And as you continue to journey down this road of listening about how to put them before us with us, you're going to see that all of our work encompasses tearing down those same forms of idolatry today, but maybe in a more palatable or acceptable context. So I will pause there, and I want to get into some of the big headlines, some of the news headlines this week, because I will tell you, Trump has been busy. There's been a lot going on in the world of child protection as it relates to the new Trump administration. So my engagement director, Patience Sunny, is here with me right now, and we're going to cover two of those news stories. The first one, Patience, I'd love for you to tell us about, is that President Trump has actually initiated a wave of wins for the unborn and those who are fighting to protect them. So what has he been up to in this area?
Yeah, so just in time for the March for Life, President Trump pardoned 23 pro-lifers who had been convicted under the FACE Act for protesting outside of abortion clinics. So the FACE Act is the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, which was a Clinton-era law from 1994 that was really targeting pro-lifers outside of clinics. This was the era of the rescue movement in the pro-life movement, where a lot of people were going directly into clinics to try and convince women not to have abortions, sometimes blocking clinic entrances so that the clinic couldn't open for the day in order to save the lives that would otherwise be destroyed. And 23 pro-lifers have been in prison under the Biden administration's enforcement of the FACE Act because of peaceful protest outside of clinics. So these are people who were there. They were praying outside of clinics, in some cases standing in front of the entrance, convincing people, hey, this isn't what's best for you. This isn't what's best for your child. And so these pro-lifers, peaceful protesters, had been in prison. Trump pardoned them. And then also the Attorney General's Chief of Staff, Chad Mizell, working under President Trump, issued a memo saying, until further notice, no new abortion-related FACE Act actions, criminal or civil, will be permitted without authorization from the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division. So they're really putting on hold the enforcement of this act that really has been weaponized against the pro-life movement. Under the FACE Act, it should be applying to both sides. It should also be protecting pro-life pregnancy centers. And that has not been the case. That's not how it's been enforced. Mizell's memo noted that more than 100 crisis pregnancy centers, pro-life organizations, and churches were attacked in the immediate aftermath of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. And no one was charged in many of those cases. I actually worked closely with one of the organizations that was firebombed in 2022, and there has really been a lack of justice for this. So it's really great news that this is that the Trump administration is going to stop the Biden precedent of weaponizing the FACE Act against pro-lifers and really give justice to these peaceful protesters. The other good news
Before we move on to that, to the other really big, I think, aspect of good news of this is, just to be clear, you know, I have not been a huge engaged part of the pro-life movement. I recently woke up kind of culture recently, as in the last like 12, 13 years. I'm like, I should probably get involved here. But my understanding is that there was a time where pro-lifers really were pretty aggressive. I mean, and I would say they are not. They would not have been aligning with the principles that should characterize a pro-life movement. But there really was, in some ways, times for like clinics or even women going into clinics to think, oh my gosh, I'm there's a bit of physical risk for me. But that's not what was happening with these protesters. These people were like quietly praying outside, sometimes not even interacting with the women going in. And still, the Biden administration put these grandmothers or these stay-at-home moms or these quiet, solemn, non-aggressive, peaceful protesters in prison anyway, right? That's what was going on.
Exactly. So, you know, these are people who are not causing any harm to anyone. They're just out there advocating on behalf of the preborn. And like you said, pro-life grandmothers, one of the women who was sentenced, her sentence was such that she would have spent the rest of her life in jail. Because she dared to stand up for the preborn and be a peaceful presence outside of that abortion facility. So massive injustice under the Biden administration that has now been reversed under the Trump administration. Another big injustice that we're seeing a halt to is that the pro-life journalists who blew the whistle on Planned Parenthood and their sale of aborted baby tissue, they are no longer facing any further action. They've reached a plea deal. They're not going to be charged with felony, which is a huge victory for them. Kamala Harris actually led the charge, really persecuting these pro-life journalists who went undercover, recorded Planned Parenthood executives talking about the ways that they could alter the abortion procedure in order to harvest intact organs that they could then sell for profit. And that work actually, it led to a $7.8 million settlement in which two companies admitted to illegally selling aborted fetuses from Planned Parenthood in Southern California. So their journalistic work really drew attention to a very dark and horrifying aspect of the abortion industry and brought justice. Another big story.
Just to be really clear that, you know, I want to point out the names of these activists, David Dalyden and Sandra Merritt. And I think a lot of us are familiar with David's name and face because he really did become sort of the emblem of, I would say, virtuous resistance, even though it employed tactics that maybe some people are like, is that allowed? Are you allowed to lie about your identity? And you know, so you kind of get into some kind of Christian ethics questions. But when you're talking about contributing to the state of Texas, completely overhauling, you know, their abortion laws, contributing to that. I mean, the truth is his work, even though he was absolutely under the legal gun for what, 7 or 8 years now, I mean, like really heavily prosecuted. His work exposed the absolute corruption and seediness of this industry, and he has probably saved thousands of children as a result. So I just want to say their names out loud. Absolutely. May God raise up more people who are willing to undertake personal risk, physical risk, legal risk to advance the cause of the least of these.
Yeah, absolutely. Real pro-life heroes. Another story to hit real quickly before we go to the second segment. Less of a win for the pro-life cause, unfortunately. There was a bill that passed the U.S. House but did not pass the Senate that would have provided justice for babies who survive abortion. So this was a born alive protection bill that did not end up passing the Senate. But what's happening is there are actually hundreds of babies who survive abortion and who are then left to die. And there are a small handful of states that actually report on this. And just looking at the statistics from those states, we can reasonably say that about 0.05% of abortions lead to a baby who's born alive. And based on the information from the states that do report, those babies do not survive. They're usually not given life-saving care. Sometimes they're given comfort care. But most of the time, they are simply set aside to die. One nurse actually told Live Action about her experience of seeing a baby just brought to a soiled utility room, and it survived for 45 minutes and then died after this botched abortion. So this bill would have brought justice for those babies. It would have required life-saving care. Unfortunately, the Senate voted against it. It's being framed as an attack on so-called abortion rights. But it's important to recognize that this actually isn't even about legalized abortion. It's saying, hey, this thing is already illegal. It's already illegal to refuse life-saving care to a baby. And we're clarifying that, no, really, we mean it. And that a baby who is born alive should not be left to die simply because they're not wanted.
We look at that kind of thing and we say, how could anybody vote against offering life-saving care to a living child who is likely in even more pain than an average newborn because they have been chemically burned by some kind of process, or there was an effort to mutilate them, to abort them and get them. I mean, so these are kids that are not just need the comfort of general newborns, but they are in a medically, like they have a medical emergency. And you have people saying, no, we will not offer life-saving care. At minimum, it will become like we might dull their pain, but a lot of times you wrap the kid up in a blanket and you set them aside to die. And we look at that and we say, how monstrous. This is obscene. And yet, it's actually pretty logically consistent, because a lot of these babies, if they were in the womb, you could, and obviously they had already attempted to terminate their life. How is the child's status any different now that they are 5 seconds, 5 minutes, 50 minutes on the other side of the womb? It's the same child, right? They're at the same stage of development. They're just as human as they were before. And so I think that what this does is it reveals the threat of this progressive anti-child worldview in terms of, like, look, if you can kill them in the womb, there's no logical consistency of saying, and then you have to save them out of the womb. All the more reason for us to humanize children. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us. And as you know, the general editor for our most recent project, Pro Child Politics, which takes our Put Kids Before Adult lens and applies it to every major political issue that we are facing today and that we're going to face in the future. So we conscripted some of the top subject matter experts on every one of these evergreen issues to write about what would happen if we prioritized kids. What would happen if we looked at energy or the environment or immigration through the lens of child protection? And one area that we really needed to focus on was the issue of our mounting national debt. Now, this is something that is not very sexy. It doesn't have like really specific victims, like you could see a trafficking victim or a child who was subjected to transgender treatments who is now dealing with lifelong medical harms. But there are very real victims when we get the question of debt wrong. And so I have invited the contributor, the author of our debt chapter, to come on and talk with you a little bit about why debt is actually a matter of justice for children. So today we are going to hear from Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Katie. I love this project.
Yeah, me too. I learned a lot. And I will tell you that, you know, I've gone around, I've done some speaking recently on different podcasts, different platforms about kind of what it looks like to vote pro-child in this upcoming election. And when I talk about how we are financially harming children, I quote this story that you begin your chapter with, which is your friend who had a baby. Baby's name is Noah. And the day that Noah is born, Noah owes $78,000 in national debt. And what I actually really appreciated about your chapter is a lot of the times when we talk about fiscal matters or, you know, taxes or debt, we use things like terms like unsustainable, right? Or it's not manageable. But the words that you use in your chapter is, this is what we are doing right now with racking up the debt is it's fiscal child abuse. You say it's a moral failing. You say it's not just unsustainable, it's unethical. So tell me why you feel like what is going on with debt in the United States today is not just a matter of like balancing numbers, but it's really a matter of ethics and morals.
Well, first of all, I do think it's helpful to divide these things by the number of children or the number of people or the number of households, because when you talk about billions and trillions, it doesn't mean anything. You know, most people, about the largest number they can comprehend is about what their house is worth. Okay. So when you start talking millions, billions, trillions, you lose people immediately. When you talk about $80,000, people kind of get what that is as a debt number, because that's in the range of things that they're familiar with and that they deal with. And it's a big number. And, you know, there are no, when you pile these types of, and it's more now, because I think that was the number from 2023. It's probably like 85,000 now, something like, I don't have exactly, but it's been growing pretty rapidly. And when you pile that kind of a debt burden on kids the day they're born, and it grows, you know, projected to grow, you know, to 200,000 by the time they're 20 or 25, and to keep going from there if we kind of stay on the path that we're on. That doesn't mean, you know, it's easy to just say, oh my God, it's the end of the universe, everyone will die. People don't listen to that either when you exaggerate. But it really does mean a diminished quality of life. It means that our children and grandchildren will not have the same opportunities and the same quality of life that we did, because that debt needs to be addressed one way or another, right? Most likely, because the politicians tend to take the coward's way out, it'll be addressed through inflation. It'll be addressed, you know, not through huge tax hikes, which would cause a lot of other problems and undermine the economy, and not their spending cuts, which they've generally shown an inability to agree on. It'll be accomplished by asking the Fed to print the money when they would have an otherwise failed Treasury auction. And we kind of got a preview of what that was like with all of the COVID spending when we had that huge bout of inflation. But if we stay on the path that we're on, the only way we're going to be able to finance this debt burden when our kids and our grandkids become kind of the working population and take over will be to inflate it away, will be to make it in a less of a burden by printing more money. And that has a major negative impact on quality of life, a major negative impact on the economic performance overall. And we're headed towards a situation, and by the way, the alternatives, continuing to finance it forever with real bond buyers, even if you avoid kind of the inflation scenario, those are all negative too. So all of the options are bad. There are no good options, and they become worse over time the longer we wait to address this. And the consequence of that is a society that will be poorer than it needs to be, than it otherwise would be, that we will not continue to have the kind of rising living standards and kind of the kind of rising opportunity that we enjoyed and that our parents enjoyed before us. And so this is a very real issue. And, you know, there are only a few ways this gets resolved. Either we reach a Greece-style crisis-type scenario where we can't make the numbers add up, and we have a crisis situation, and some crash action is taken, which would be very damaging economically, or we slowly erode over time, which means we're going to have lower growth every year, which means living standards don't improve, and over time you end up at the same place as where you would have with that crash scenario, or maybe, and this is the dream, we get out ahead of it and we make conscious choices and we have some agreement over, you know, how much of, you know, the economy, the burden of government should be and what our priorities should be. We impose some caps and some limitations and we address this in a positive way. And, you know, that's the dream. And maybe whoever the next president is really does bring in Elon Musk or Mark Cuban, depending on who wins. And they get serious about cutting government spending. That would be the dream scenario. But I'm just not very optimistic right now, unfortunately.
Well, it would take a lot of courage to address it. And we'll get to your one possible best case scenario in a minute, which in essence means adults need to do hard things now, because the alternative is for kids to do an even greater hard thing in the future. And that is sort of what we see as the hallmark of putting us before them, is we are just offloading the work for the next generation. And in this case, you know, we're making kids pay for stuff that they didn't benefit from, they didn't agree to, and they might never even like know that they, signed their name to this because it happened 10 years before they were born. So what we did with your chapter is what we did with all the chapters, which is you start with the story of a real life child who is harmed, and you talk about Noah and how much federal debt he is going to owe. And then I asked all the contributors to outline the lies, the things that we hear so much about this area, and just tell us what those lies are and then how the lies harm kids. So I'm going to just read. You listed several lies, and then you've got one truth about the whole thing. So here's the lies about federal debt. Number one, federal debt stimulates the economy. Number two, federal spending is an investment in our future. Number three, we can solve our fiscal problems by taxing the rich. Number four, more spending means better outcomes. Number five, cutting spending will hurt the poor and vulnerable. Number six, Social Security is fair to all generations. So I reread that this morning, and really, we've got all of these lies, we've got all of these narratives spun around debt to try to get people more comfortable with it, to try to say it's no big deal if we're spending more. And you said the problem really is not necessarily that we're not bringing in enough taxes. The real reality is we have an addiction to spending, and taxing cannot solve this. It is simply that we have out of control spending. So if you could just explain to our followers, where are the main areas where that spend, because there's some federal spending that's justified, what isn't justified, what is really irresponsible, and what is truly wasteful that is driving up the debt?
Yeah, thank you. I think that we've got basically three kind of buckets of federal spending that account for most of what federal spending is. One is the defense budget, and the defense budget is very large, although Republicans continue to say not large enough, and they may have a point because we've got, you know, a lot of threats and risks in the world right now, and we sort of, you know, we're still number one, but we're not as dominant number one in defense spending as we have been in the recent past, and you know, you could make a case that we should spend more. The other area is the entitlements, and particularly Social Security and Medicare. With an aging population, these have increased very, very rapidly. Although we should point out that for Social Security, it's still a pretty bad deal for recipients. The vast majority of them paid in a lot more than they're really getting in benefits. With any kind of market return, they should be getting much, much higher benefits. And that's why politically it's been so toxic whenever you talk about cutting benefits, because most people say, hey, I paid into that my whole life, and I'm getting a bad deal, not a good deal that needs to be reduced. And so that's been very resistant to change. And then you've got the other sort of giant bucket is domestic discretionary spending. And this is where the Democrats really have all of their priorities, and they've pushed very hard for things like federal education spending and federal housing subsidies and all of sort of the other various federal transportation spending. And, you know, some of it you could say is necessary and actually justified, like, you know, true interstate roads and bridges, I think most people would agree is a legitimate federal function. But even in transportation, a ton of what the federal government does is really not interstate, really could be picked up at the state and local level. And the education department has basically become the biggest, worst-run bank in the world, because most of what they do now is college loans, which, you know, a lot of them don't get paid back, and Democrats now don't want a lot of them to be paid back. They want to use it as a mechanism for redistribution of wealth and sort of backdoor free college rather than, it's interesting, when they passed Obamacare, they said, this is one of the ways we're going to pay for it, is the banks make so much money on student lending, we're going to have the Treasury take it over and use it as a revenue source. Now it takes huge losses instead. And then you could go through kind of all the other cabinet departments as well. They all sort of fit into this non-defense discretionary bucket as well. But one of the things that the politicians did really going back, I don't know, 10 or 15 years now, is they kind of had this agreement between Democrats and Republicans to mostly align defense and non-defense, which is to say, hey, we'll only cut a dollar of non-defense if we cut a dollar of defense. And if we increase a dollar of defense, we'll increase a dollar of non-defense. And this kind of got both parties in favor of bigger spending basically every time. Because instead of saying, you know, what can we do to limit spending and address our fiscal challenges, both parties said, look at this wonderful compromise we made where, you know, we increased spending on what the Republicans want to increase spending on, and we also increased spending on what the Democrats want to increase spending on. And, hey, we won't pay the bills. Your children and grandchildren will.
Phil, give me some examples of outrageous, outlandish spending that our kids are going to be paying for in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Well, Rand Paul does this report every year where he compiles like the craziest things. And a lot of them are NIH grant spending for like studies of shrimp walking on treadmills and like, you know, just the experimentation on beagles and all this kind of stuff. So probably the most outlandish stuff is the kind of the wacky scientific research stuff that goes on with our tax dollars where there's no obvious use for any of the data that comes out of it. And Rand Paul does that every year. There are a lot of groups that do these reports. Citizens Against Government Waste does an annual report as well. I mean, I think that coming out of COVID, the biggest area is just the astonishing amount of fraud that we now have. And, you know, there's been, you know, for many years, it was sort of this running joke that people said, what do you want to cut in the federal budget? And people said waste, fraud, and abuse. And then they kind of got mocked by the experts who said, oh, that's such a tiny amount. I actually think it's become a quite large amount now. You look at, you know, for instance, the unemployment fraud that went on when they were doing those $1,000 a week benefits during COVID. And I saw one estimate that there was $200 billion of fraud just that went to China. Chinese claims for various unemployment benefits and other COVID relief efforts. And so I think that the amount of fraud now is very, very high. There was a recent report from Paragon Health Institute that found rampant fraud in Obamacare subsidies. There are now lots of brokers out there that sign people who are not actually eligible up for Obamacare, and they don't really do verification of eligibility. So that now runs into the tens of billions of dollars. And so just almost anywhere you look in the federal budget now, you find not just things that we could, you know, that liberals and conservatives could disagree about whether government should do, but just outright waste, just astonishing waste is now throughout the federal budget. You know, can you get all the way to a balanced budget just by eliminating that? Probably not, but you can make a huge difference in the trajectory if you actually got serious about that.
Wow, amazing. So then you give us one truth. The one truth that you say when it comes to spending is that there is a ticking time bomb happening when it comes to our debt burden. And you say, if we don't apply the brakes, debt disaster will visit our children. You make it very, very clear that there is a simple solution. It's not an easy solution, but it is a simple solution. And that is that we make difficult decisions now that include structural reforms, especially to Social Security, federal health care, and that we have to live within spending caps. We have to cap our spending. Tell me, are you optimistic that something like that could take place anytime in the near future?
I'm not very optimistic, certainly with the current power sharing arrangement with a Republican House, Democratic White House and Senate. There's really no opportunity to solve this issue. You know, we have sort of these imaginary leverage these sort of imaginary leverage points where we think, well, government funding is up at the end of September, we're going to drive a hard bargain and force Democrats to negotiate. Or when we had, last year we had the debt ceiling up and we said, this time we're taking it to the mat and we're fighting. But the challenge is that with the media behind the Democrats and with them really having no interest in spending limitations, what, Republicans sort of posture and say they're going to fight and then they cave because they don't want to be blamed for, breaching the debt ceiling or having a big government shutdown. And those always seem to be political losses for them. And then you're even in an even worse position to try to address these problems substantively. And so with a power sharing arrangement, we're just unlikely to see any action on this. And then you have your alternative scenario. So let's say Democrats sweep everything in this election. I actually think we'd be in a much worse fiscal position because, the Biden budget was $7 trillion in spending. A lot of that was, one of the reasons that inflation has come down from that 7, 8, 9% to, 2 or 3% is we've had divided government. And divided government means gridlock. And, they certainly haven't cut anything, but they've rejected a lot of the proposed spending increases, unlike what happened when Democrats had unified control. And so I think that's why the outlook has improved marginally. And that's why inflation has come down a lot. If you have Democrats controlling everything coming out of this election, they're going to pass $7 trillion in annual budget, and then they're going to add on top of that maybe some giant new federal child care benefit and maybe some giant new federal health care benefit and maybe another round of Green New Deal spending like they had in Inflation Reduction Act. You kind of add these things together, and they're going to take that fiscal train wreck crisis date from 10 or 15 years in the future to 2 or 3 years in the future, or even immediate or even chronic inflation of 10% a year, as far as the eye can see. Now,
Phil, we've got to cut off there, but I want to thank you so much. The reason I asked Phil to write this is if you need more information, go and follow him, because 3,000 words is not going to be enough. Thanks, Phil.
You're welcome.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us. Obviously, we want to be pro-child in our politics, and that's exactly what we were talking with Phil Kirpin about in our last segment on why we need to have a pro-child lens when we're thinking about national debt. Do go get the book Pro-Child Politics. Learn about why every major cultural, economic, and national issue ultimately redounds to the benefit of children or victimizes children when we get it wrong. We do need to be thinking about these things on a national issue. There's a lot happening in our national politics that has a very direct implication on children's lives, their interests, their rights, their well-being, and their health. So we want to talk about what's happening in your world. Like, how do we apply some of what we're seeing on the national level, or even some of these big ideas that we cover at Them Before Us, and what does it look like in our own lives? So we're going to kick things off in this segment where we answer your questions that you've sent in through the week. We're going to kick it off with some of the executive actions that have been issued from the president's desk since he took office only 2 weeks ago. And I've got Jen Friesen, my training director here at Them Before Us, to answer and pitch some of these questions to us. But first, Jen, I'd love for you to give us a rundown or just a quick hit on the executive orders that have been issued by President Trump that directly affects or intersects with our work of child protection here at Them Before Us.
Hey, Katie. Hey, everybody. Yeah, it feels like he's been president so much longer than he has just because of how many things have happened. And we joke about like the news junkies and the people who are very favorable to what's going on. We can't wait to read the news every day because it's just good news when it comes to policy and some of the changes and things that are being made. The big one that this impacts kids at some extent because it kind of talks about women and men in women's spaces. They did the defending women from gender ideology extremism. So that's men in women's prisons and men in women's sports and men in changing rooms with little kids, right? So again, that is all of these are so common sense. We are just so thankful they're happening, but it's annoying that it has to be said at all. Enforcing the Hyde Amendment, which I believe is federal funding, like outside the country for abortion. They're enforcing that, not letting our tax dollars go to kill babies in other countries. That's about protecting children. one that says protecting children from chemical and surgical mutilation. I love that they're not playing the word games that have been happening. We're not calling it gender reassignment surgery. We're not calling it transgender surgery. We're calling it what it is: chemical and surgical mutilation of children.
Yep, I agree. I love it all. I want you to continue down this road of executive actions that are going to target, you know, protecting children's life, family, mind, and body, because ultimately, I think that we could even find connections through a lot of the other executive actions that have been taking place to child well-being, but these ones directly connect. I mean, some of these executive actions are going to have a very immediate impact on protecting kids. So what are some of the other ones you're seeing?
The two other big ones that I liked that I think were just today or yesterday, ending radical indoctrination in K through 12. Again, we're talking about our money funding, our public tax dollars funding education, and that it should not be ideological and should not be, it shouldn't be the DEI. We saw executive orders about DEI being removed. There's impacts on our children from that, right? And then the other executive order around education was educational freedom and opportunity for families. You shouldn't be stuck in a horrible public school because of your zip code, because you don't have resources. That's going to be incredible. But even things like combating anti-Semitism, I like the idea that if you're not an American citizen and you're at a college campus on our dime, burning an American flag, flying a terrorist flag, we can say, no thanks. You don't get to be here and you don't get to go to school here. We're not trying to say you're not allowed to speak. We're not trying to say you get thrown in prison. But we're saying if you don't appreciate the opportunity of living in the United States and you're basically presenting yourself as an enemy of the United States, we don't have to fund your education to and have you live here on our tax dollars, you know?
Yeah, I have been, because I live in Seattle and because the two children that I still have at home are in public high schools, they know when there is big news that they need to be ready to, at minimum, understand the issue because they're going to come here, they're going to go to school and hear the competing views and oftentimes the deranged, distorted views of that issue presented. And so I've been having conversations with both of my boys before. They're like, Mom, just can you let me know what happened yesterday? Like, what happened yesterday in Trump land that I need to know about so that I can be aware of? And so, you know, we talked about the recognition of biological identity and, you know, how that's really, really important and how the, you know, just last night, the one that said, well, in fact, you know, when he handed down that there's only two genders, there is male, there's female. It is determined by your chromosome at the moment of conception. And my 17-year-old was like, awesome. Does that mean that my school is no longer going to teach the transgender insanity? I said, no, it doesn't. That is not what this means. What right. It means is that there is a broader consensus of people that are going to say biological sex is real. And the other thing I said is that there are going to be some schools that want to resist this. And now they don't have to fear the government. They don't have to fear being punished by the federal government if they say, we don't want to teach the gender ideology thing. And then last night, they're like, also, if you are teaching gender ideology, if you are specifically trying to hide your child's transgender identity from the parent, if you are presenting curriculum that says that you are either an oppressor or the oppressed simply because of your skin color, you get no federal dollars, baby. And then I was like, okay, that really will prohibit your school from teaching these. And both of my boys were like, that is, both of them were like, do you understand how this is going to revolutionize my education? Because they deal with this all the time. And I think that maybe there's some schools where kids are not facing this like full on all the time. Certainly if your kids are not at public school, you probably are not dealing with this, at least in the form of like curriculum or teachers. But my boys are going to be like, are you saying, Mom, that I have the upper hand now, that they can no longer say, you know, science is on our side and the government is on our side and all of our funding is going to push us towards this. Now the science is not on their side. The federal government will punish them if they teach these kinds of lies. And so for the first time, they're like, wait a second, the world seems to be aligning with the reality that not only I believe, but that's validated by just, you know, what is self-evident.
Right. You know, it makes me wonder too, people have talked about putting video cameras in public school classrooms, not a teacher's lounge, not a bathroom. But why should I, as a taxpayer, and if my kid is in a class, not be able to see a live stream of exactly what's being said and done the whole time? That's what's crazy about these COVID shutdowns, is they ruined it for themselves by exposing themselves, showing parents, now I can listen to what my kid is hearing from you in class. Or, you know, there should be some kind of reporting system for public employees that are pushing things out of line with the First Amendment, out of line with the Second Amendment, violating these principles of they're promoting DEI and things like that. That's scary when you think about, you know, you don't want a camera in your house that the government's watching you, but why shouldn't there be a camera where we're watching the government and making sure we're holding the people who work for us accountable? Yeah. You know,
there's definitely some privacy concerns related to filming kids, but if there's a way to just film the teacher, that would solve some of those problems. And I will say, have the kind of relationship with your kid where you don't need a camera to know what's happening in the classroom. Have the kind of relationship with your kids where they love to come home and tell you things that they hear or see in the classroom. Because number one, they know that you're not going to freak out, because they associate talking with you with feelings of relief. That's a principle we talk about a lot in our first book. In our second book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City. But then also be the kind of parent where they want to come back to you because they know that they can get the best information from you if they hear something that's concerning. So cameras, I totally understand the appeal. Even better, cultivating a relationship with your kid where you don't need cameras. You know everything because they want to tell you everything.
That's good. That's a parenting win right there. Okay, next question. Kind of based off your conversation with Phil Kirpin, our debt expert for pro-child politics, thinking about being in debt, you know, a lot of people have credit card debt, a lot of student loan debt, car debt, et cetera. When it comes to debt and money in the bank, what do you think is a good amount that people need to have before they can get married, before they can have a baby? Because there's a lot of these things that just keep delaying those next steps. What do you think?
There are a few financial considerations that you need to make when you are getting married. Unfortunately, right now in our tax code, there really is a marriage penalty where you will have to pay more in taxes if you're married versus the two of you guys living apart or maybe even living together, but unmarried. So that is one policy area that we really need to take a look at and change. We need to make it financially easier for people to get married. But I would say that there's this mindset of, I can't get married until I've paid off my debt. I can't get married until, you know, I finish my master's degree. I can't get married until I own a home. So you need to demolish that kind of mindset. You need to get married when you're ready to get married. And hopefully that is early. Hopefully you are mature enough. Hopefully you've had a very purposeful dating experience where you are measuring your compatibility and your alignment, your preparedness for marriage, not based on how much you have in the bank or even how much you have in debt, but based on, do our values align? Do we want the same things? Do we have similar expectations about roles and marriage and the goals of life and all of that? If you have found that person, get married. Obviously, I think that you should do that in a way that aligns with the wise counsel in your life. But the truth is, if you're 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, you've got a good head on your shoulders, you are dating somebody that has total value alignment, proven to have good character, tie that knot, baby. Much, much better to see marriage as a cornerstone around which you build your life together than a capstone where you figure it all out on your own and then you place marriage like a cherry on top. Ding. Why? Well, number one, especially in terms of the economic question, marriage is a wealth-building institution. You actually can accumulate and save and build wealth as a married couple in ways that singles typically don't. There's a couple reasons for that. One of them is you're not supporting two different households, but a lot of it is that if you're a guy, something about marriage means you work harder, you earn more, you ditch the bad habits sooner, you mature to mask to manhood in a way that allows you to earn more money. So marriage is good for you, even if you have some debt. It's okay, get married if you are dating the right person.
Well, and some of that might mean the wedding itself is not $50,000 or, you know, these, maybe we just adjust our expectations more. So, you know, that industry costs so much money and might be prohibitive for people thinking about getting married. So take that part off the table and crowdsource it with your friends from church and families and have it be a big party where a bunch of people bring food and it only costs a few thousand dollars. And then you're kind of maybe it's not one more debt that you're adding before you get married.
Yeah. Good tips.
Yeah. Okay. Final question, kind of more from me. I've thought about, you know, you guys have joked about what am I ever going to write? We've got a stack of books back here that, you know, people on the team have written. And I was like, maybe I could write some fiction, but should Them Before Us write a dystopian, we should do like a graphic novel or something. But thinking about all these child rights violations, like what would a world look like if just this keeps accelerating to the point that it could? Are you interested in writing a graphic novel for Them Before Us?
All right. So interesting you asked me this, because I was just talking with somebody who's super deep in the publishing world, because I was talking about publishing another book that could be the basis for a curriculum for teens. So sort of a Them Before Us teen edition. And she was like, FYI, that book is not going to sell. Like, if you actually want to sell books, that is not the book. And I said, well, I really want it to be the groundwork for a curriculum that we will hopefully produce using videos. So I don't need the book to be a bestseller. But she said, but let me tell you, books are flying off the shelf these days when it's young adult, and especially like the romance. Like, and let's be honest, a lot of that teen romance is soft porn for girls. Like boys tend to gravitate towards porn that is on screens. Girls find their porn in highly relational environments, oftentimes in a fictitious setting. And so I'm obviously not going to write a young adult book like that. I don't think anybody should. But the bottom line is, kids are reading, and some of them are reading a lot. So how is it that you can take these truths and fit it into a medium where we already have the data to say that not only will people buy this, but they will read it, and they might read 50 a year if you've been able to hit the right genre for them. So really what I'm saying is, there's a place for curriculum, and there's a place for nonfiction, and there's a place for podcasts, but there is something that art can do that no other mediums can do. And unfortunately, I think Christians and conservatives have pulled out a lot of those creative spaces. And as a result, all you get is smut and indoctrination in some of that young adult fiction.
That reminds me of a good conversation we have with our book author for Pro Child Politics, Christian. I'm blanking on his last name, but such cool art and such a great conversation just about the necessity of Christians and good art to help communicate beauty and truth to people.
Yeah, Christian Watson. And I will never look at that book cover without thinking, thank God that was the best money that we ever spent was to create that book cover, because I still love it. So the bottom line is, I was just reading Matthew with my youngest today about you're the salt of the earth. Take that salt into all of your different vocations, all your different conversations, and then you really will be doing the will of God. Thank you for joining us. Don't be a stranger. Send us your questions during the week and join us again next weekend for Them Before Us Radio.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.